House Committee on Health and Human Services to order this Wednesday, April 20th, 2005. Good morning, everyone. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2105. This is the bill that defines aesthetics and modifies the meaning of barber and hair design nail technology for purposes of regulation by the Board of Cosmetology. We're in a work session. We have a dash one amendment. Colleagues, you'll have that in your packet. I'd like an amendment, a motion on the dash one.
That's in our packet, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, it's right below the 2105.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to House Bill 2105.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Tomei moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 2105. Is there any objection? Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, just a discussion. Can we have staff tell us exactly what the amendment does to 2105?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As the chair reflected, behind your SMS, you have a hand in gross, House Bill 2105, that incorporates the dash one amendments. What the dash one amendments are doing is currently the law restricts individuals employed by healthcare facilities if they're providing the service for the purpose of basic hygiene and comfort. The dash one amendment expands the exemption to include health professionals acting within their scope of another license under the jurisdiction of the hospital, long-term care facility, or nursing home, etc.
Question, Mr. Chair. That would not endanger any Medicare funds that are being utilized in these residential facilities.
I believe the answer is no to your question. I can't tell you definitively, but I don't know that issue came up.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, fiscal has not seen this amendment yet, so if something should come back where that is an impact, they will issue a statement accordingly, and then the committee will have an opportunity to look at that.
Does this bill have a subsequent referral?
No, it does not.
So there would be no referral for Ways and Means if there is a fiscal in the loss of any federal funding.
I should think at that point, Representative, we would refer it back to committee.
Okay.
Clerk, we'll call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Are we putting any amendments or
yes, the amendments.
Aye.
Aye.
Same vote.
Butler.
Aye.
Chair
votes aye. The dash one amendments are adopted. I'd like a motion on the amended bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2105 to the full House to be passed recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2105 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
I think I did too.
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye. House Bill 2105, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Can I have a motion for the consent calendar?
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Tomei moves that House Bill 2105 be placed on a consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Any objections? House Bill 2105 is ordered placed on the consent calendar. We'll close the work session on 2105. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2358. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3059. Sandy, would you be good enough to introduce these measures, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2358 directs the Department of Education to award grants to school districts and public charter schools to provide automatic external defibrillators in public school facilities. It has an emergency clause and is effective July 1, 2005. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And in attached here, I believe the sponsor of the bill, Representative Hass's office, has submitted a dash one amendment that they will be speaking to. If you don't have that, please let me know. House Bill 3059, again, Chief sponsor is Representative Hass. This is requires automatic external defibrillators to be annually tested for the purposes of liability involving person rendering emergency medical assistance with an automatic external defibrillator. And I do have amendments to that. I just got them. I need to go and make copies, Mr. Chair. I apologize. We have copies, Mr. Chair.
All right. Sure. Representative Flores, you're here? Would you like to come up? Good morning. Welcome.
Yeah. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Linda Corey, State Representative for House District 51. And if it pleases the Chair, I would also request that you open a public hearing on House Bill 2826, which is the bill that I'm here to speak in support of, because it does deal with defibrillators as well.
Yes, I missed that one. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2826. Thank you, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Once again, I'm Linda Flores. And I'm here in as a sponsor of House Bill 2826 at the request of Paige Spencer. Paige Spencer is a beautiful young woman, friend of my daughter's, early 30s, a beautiful young mother of three, and unfortunately a beautiful young widow. Paige Spencer, who asked me to bring this bill forward, is traveling in Ohio, visiting her in-laws. And I do have for you a copy of an email letter that she sent, and I would like to read it to you on her behalf, and I do have copies for the committee. My name is Paige Spencer, and I am writing in support of House Bill 2826, which, with its amendments, would require fitness facilities to have an automated external defibrillator, we shall refer to hereinafter as AEDs, on site. After the untimely death of my husband in February of 2004 to sudden cardiac arrest while at 24-hour fitness in Lake Oswego, I've become passionate about advocating the importance of AEDs in public places, especially those types of places where one may tend to physically exert themselves. Each day, sudden cardiac arrest claims the lives of over 450,000 people, according to the Center for Disease Control. To break it down, 1,200 victims a day, 50 lives an hour, and one death every minute. We must do what we can to prevent this from happening to other families. Our baby girl was just 4 months old when she lost her daddy. Not to mention the loss and emptiness that our two daughters have suffered through. Our other two daughters have suffered through. In the passing of this bill, we can spare but one family the devastation, the complete agony of losing a husband, father, son, brother, and friend that we have experienced, and surely we will have succeeded. Thank you for your consideration of this matter that we hold so close to our hearts. And that was from Paige Taylor, Katie, and Peyton Spencer. Attached to her testimony, you will find also letters from Kirk Spencer's parents and some supportive friends. Just notes of support for the concept of House Bill 2826 to have AEDs in fitness facilities. Now, Mr. Chair, there are amendments in process of being crafted to this bill, and as I do believe you were in receipt of a letter from Richard Laser, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Early Defibrillation Law and Policy Center. Those bills, those amendments will be coming forward, and if, as it is my understanding, there will be a morphing of the other defibrillator bills into one, those would also be incorporated. So at this time, I bring the bill forward for your consideration with the understanding there will be some amending to this language and the potential creation of a, shall we say, omnibus bill in this regard.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions or comments for Representative Flores? I would make the comment that I requested Representative Flores to send a defibrillator bill to us from the House Education Committee, which Representative Flores chairs, so that we could take a look at that bill.
That is underway as well.
Terrific.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Refresh my memory. Did this bill come to us last session and was lost during the final days? Or it seemed to me we had pushed in that direction 2 years ago.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, it is my understanding that this is not the first go-round.
Start.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Representative. We're going to continue to do some work on this bill. see, may I have Jim Green, Chuck Bennett, and Gary, are you here by yourself, or are you with Mr. Thomas? Okay, Gary, come forward as well. I'll ask Gary to start, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Gary Conkling, here today appearing on behalf of the Beaverton School District, and I've submitted for you a letter from Dan Thomas, who is the risk manager for the Beaverton School District, and I won't try to read the letter. The point that Mr. Thomas makes is that school districts such as Beaverton are concerned about the liability of putting AEDs in schools, and would hope that legislation similar to House Bill 3059 could be adopted to modify the Oregon Good Samaritan law to cover a reasonable standard that would provide them the assurance then to go ahead and accept these instruments inside schools. And as he notes, there's a considerable amount of interest in the community to help school districts acquire these instruments. But at the moment, at least Beaverton has decided not to install any because of the liability concerns which this bill would address.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Okay. Chuck, go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. We just wanted to appear in support of House Bill 3059. We have also had a chance to take a look at the amendments, and we think that either the amended or unamended version would be fine with us. We understand that Representative Haas has worked with others who have interest in this bill and develop the Dash 1 amendments that assist in making the bill more acceptable to them. The language appears to update defibrillator language, anything that clarifies this issue and makes it more possible for districts like Beaverton to install these machines, we think is a good thing, and hope that you can move this bill along. Thank you.
Thank you. Green.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. I'd just echo what Mr. Bennett has said with regard to the Dash 1s. I believe that takes care of some concerns of other folks in the room had as the bill was drafted, and I think it would apply that Oregon Good Samaritan law across a level playing field, that schools could be part of that and protected should they put AEDs in their buildings and if they use them and provide the proper training. And as to House Bill 2358 and the amendment for House Bill 2358, which would direct the Department of Ed to go after grants, OSBA is also in support of that bill and the amendment for that bill. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions for the panelists? Representative Greenlee.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question? Are we going to be hearing any testimony on the use of the external defibrillator?
Before we move these bills out, that's one of the things I wanted to do, because I really don't know how they work. I don't know how the layperson figures out that somebody's having a heart attack and
implement. It would be very useful to hear from the emergency physician group,
sure.
I think, on this one.
Sure, we'll spend some time working on that. Additional questions or comments? Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Get Senator Bates to come and talk.
Right. Is there a John Matsuo? Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Representative Dalto, representatives, and Representative Greenlake, I'm actually the person to answer your question right at this point in time. Thank you for providing me the opportunity to speak to you today on behalf of House Bill 2358. My name is John Matsuo. I'm the principal at North Plains Elementary School in the Hillsborough School District. I'm here to tell you a story about why AEDs in the schools are important and to show that they do work. I first learned about automatic external defibrillators 4 years ago following the Graham Jones tragedy in Beaverton. My school also had a student who had Long's QT syndrome, and we started to look into it. Our district decided that it was a worthwhile and valuable medical accommodation to put the AEDs into our school. Every year, our office staff has been trained, and that's for 4 years now. Every year during the training, the firemen that give the training tell us that it's very unlikely that it would be the student that we actually have identified that we would ever use it on. It's more likely that it would be a student or a parent or a staff member. This year in particular, a lot of the training focused around the difference between the sounds of gasping, breathing, or gasping versus breathing. On March 15th, Wayne Flock, a 50-year-old former stroke victim and parent volunteer, came into our school. He was signing in. He fell to the ground in our office, and I was called from across the building and was told that at first glance, we were told that he was having a seizure, partially because of those gasping sounds that he was making. My office manager, Jody Potter, assessed quickly that he was not breathing, and I started giving rescue breathing myself. Well, she went and got the AED that was in our office. I gave him two quick breaths. Because he is a large man with a larger mouth and a beard, it was hard to get a complete seal on him. As Jody came over with the AED, connected to that as a rescue breather, she gave me that. I put it on his mouth, tried to reopen the airway as she was hooking the AED onto him, gave him more breaths, and then we had the AED machine attached. When we looked at the readout within 29 seconds that we had the machine attached to his body, he had actually gone into tachycardia, defibrillations. It had detected a motion, a little bit of a seize, and it said out loud so we could hear, assessing or motion detected, reassessing now. And then it said, no heartbeat, shock now. Jody and I looked at each other for a split second. I said, do it. She pushed the button, and we sent 200 joules of electricity through his body. And still within that 29 seconds, we found out later on the printout that he had achieved full sinus rhythm. After that, I rolled him to his side. He began to drool and then vomit violently. The AED continued to assess. It would tell us out loud in a clear and audible voice to assess again, to check signs. It would say no CPR indicated, there is a heartbeat, there is a rhythm, no shock is indicated, continue on. The fire department arrived 3 minutes later, and just about that time Wayne's wife came. He was on the ground still being tended to. As he was, again, in that 3 minutes, Jody and I were comforting him as he's starting to regain consciousness. I took Wayne's wife, Jamie, to the hospital, and the ambulance. We got there about the same time as the ambulance. As we got there, they opened the ambulance door. At this time, he was sitting up. He was speaking. He was coherent and speaking as clearly as I've heard him speak in the last 2 years. He didn't remember anything happening. His recollection was from the time that he was signing in to the time that he fell, or till the time, actually, not falling. He remembered signing in, and the next thing he remembered was waking up with EMTs all around him. The emergency room staff and the EMTs both told Wayne's wife that there was no question that without the immediate work that the office staff did, he would have died by the time the EMTs had got there. Many nights in my sleep, I have seen his eyes, both open and glazed, staring at me. Then one eye closed. I hear the gasps of life going out of his body. I remember trying to remain calm all the while, thinking, there is no way we are going to let you die here. Our school cannot take one more tragedy. Some say that the AED is scary and the liability is too great. I know that despite my many years of CPR training, and that I know I could do it correctly, the AED provides peace of mind. It takes a lot of the thinking out of the way as to whether or not there is a pulse whether or not there's a pulse going on and what type it is. I think it's more scary to not have one. By some sense of fate, North Plains Elementary School is one of the very few elementary schools that has an AED. All of the Hillsborough High Schools now do have one, and most of the middle schools are in process, and we are trying to get them into all of our schools. But as you can imagine, the training is both expensive and timely, so we are working very hard to do that. I'd like to thank you again for the opportunity to speak to you today. Thank you for considering House Bill 2358. I know that Wayne Flock and his family thank you as well. And if you have any questions for me, I'd be glad to answer them as best I can.
Thank you very much. Representative Greenlee?
No, I think we need testimony from of a different nature.
Sure. Representative Boone?
I just want to reiterate what Mr. Matsuo said about it giving the peace of mind, because sometimes you can't hear the heartbeat, there's other noise around, and you're not sure. And the time it takes to become sure, the machine will let you know. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Representative also, thank you, Representative Boone. Thank you, Paul.
President Hass. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Hass, House District 27. I will try to duplicate what others have said about the benefits of AED. I handed out a little fact sheet on it. House Bill 2358 has an amendment with it, which was sort of our buy-off, if you will, from the Department of Education to support this. And it took away that sort of a heavy mandate on it. My purpose here was to introduce to you the mother of Eddie Barnett, the basketball player at Grant High School, who died of a heart attack a month or two ago, and she is on her way here and hopes to get a chance to talk to you, if not here before the committee, maybe some of you later. So that's why I was here today. The bill, the reason I was inspired to bring this forward is because of a compelling story similar to the one you just heard of a 7-year-old boy who had a heart attack in a swimming pool in Beaverton. And he was he ended up dying, even though there were two lifeguards and two physicians tending him as he died. And one of the physicians was a cardiac surgeon. And four people qualified, but there was nothing they could do. The doctor said we didn't need four people, we needed one of these. And that's what would have saved him. And there are, since I started looking at this issue a couple of years ago, I've gone to conferences where it's common for people to get up and say, "Hi, my name is Joe Smith, and 6 months ago I died. But thanks to one of these devices, I came back." And to me, these are kind of the kind of the fire extinguishers of our new century. They're not going to be used very much, but when they do get used and when they're needed, they can save lives. And I just think it makes a lot of sense to put them in our schools. And so I encourage your support of this, and we have to take any questions that you might have of this and the other bill that will help schools maintain these. Dr. Bates is here. He's one of the chief sponsors here, and I think he'll give you some more reasons why this is a good idea.
Would you like to come up? Yeah. Representative Hass, before you arrived, there was a request by the panel to get more information about sort of how people use these devices and how they're able to have the knowledge to use the devices and what the training is like to use the devices. And we got a perspective from a principal from North Plains Elementary, but I think there was a desire to have more information about the issue from a sort of medical perspective.
Which we know.
Can I comment to that? Hi. Mr. Chair and fellow members of the committee, my name for the record is Alan Bates. I'm a state senator from Southern Oregon. I also happen to be a physician. Thank you for an opportunity to testify on this bill. The question you seem to want to be answered is, how does this machine work and what do they do? Defibrillators are an electronic marvel. When I first started into the healthcare field as a medical student, to defibrillate somebody was a major task. We had to determine what the rhythm was, because if you give them a shock with the wrong rhythm in their heart, you can actually cause more damage. I remember putting paddles, what we call paddles, on people, stand back, and we give them a certain number of volts. We usually started at 200 and worked our way up to 400, and it was a major trauma for the patient and a pretty major trauma for the medical students and doctors standing around, too, if anyone made a mistake. These new machines are really amazing. They can read the rhythm for you, so there's no question of whether you can hurt the patient or not. They are incredibly simple to use, cannot cause any damage or pain or suffering to anybody using them. We took one of these to a fifth grade class and gave it to the class with simple instructions inside and said, how would you use this? The fifth graders figured it out in about 20 minutes. Even minimally trained people know how to use these machines. If you have somebody who's down, who is or is not breathing, you put one of these machines on them and the machine will talk to you and tell you if you need to do anything. If you do need to do anything, it'll tell you exactly what to do. It's truly an amazing device. When I first came to this building as a representative a few years ago, we didn't have any in this building. And we've got two now. They should be actually in all public buildings, but especially it's important they be in schools. You've all heard of the athlete who suddenly collapses and dies, and there's case after case after case. It appears that young people who have the type of arrhythmia we're talking about, ventricular fibrillation, are especially susceptible to that at times of exercise, during games, on the playground, other times. These things can actually save those people's lives. Most of those young people have a correctable lesion in their heart. If you get them through that first episode, you can get that correct either by putting a pacemaker in with a defibrillator built into it or by correcting the actual defect in the heart. So these are life-saving devices. Unfortunately, we can't afford to fund them at every single school in Oregon, but this bill steps up to say, and on a permissive basis, that you can get these into your schools. You can look for funding for them, that the Department of Education will look for funding for them. And it raises public awareness tremendously to have these in our schools, have these out in the public where people can see them and become aware of them. I think as we move along the next few years, people are going to demand these more and more and more because they are so life-saving. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to take any questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, one other point on these. They won't work if there is no heart defect. In other words, if someone's passed out for other reasons and you put these on, it just won't work.
But can we test it on Dr. Bates?
You can test it on me right now.
It has a heart.
It'd be scary if it went off. Don't work. You know? they really are foolproof. They're safe devices, and their ability to read the rhythm and tell you if something needs to be done or not is amazing. And they won't allow you to hit, if you hit the button and the wrong rhythm's there, it won't go off. They're an amazing device.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What kind of a time period, Senator Bates, do you have? Minute, 3 minutes, 5 minutes?
With each passing minute, you lose more and more of a chance to revive somebody. The important time is this first 2 or 3 minutes. However, that depends on what's going on with the patient. There's a physician in Portland, Dr. Baumgartner, who is a gastroenterologist. 2 years ago, he was in Joseph, Oregon, and at a square dance with some people who were, let's just say, above the age of 50. A lady there collapsed on the floor. A good doctor is 65 or thereabouts, and he had not done CPR since, you know, medical school. Basically, he'd been certified every 2 years, as we all are. They did, this woman was completely unconscious and they could not obtain any heartbeat. They did CPR on her for 25 to 30 minutes while they called around the county trying to find a defibrillator. Mm. One was found 25 minutes later and used successfully. She was transported to Portland, had a coronary bypass. He got a phone call 2 weeks later thanking him for saving her life. So the time is important, but with right CPR you can extend that time. 1 or 2 or 3 minutes is vital in these things, but don't count on having 20 or 30 minute delays in these. Right. The first minute is the most important. Second, third minutes, you're losing brain, you're having brain damage, organ damage as time goes on. You can maintain some of that with CPR, but don't count on it. So, to be perfectly honest, each minute is vital. The faster you get this done, the better you're doing. To have someone as well trained as a doctor do the CPR is unusual, But even then, you can't always save people. We've had cases where excellent CPR was given to young people, no defibrillator available, and the patient could not be revived. So it's variable. But the first minutes are extremely important, and that's why it's important to have these machines capable of being used immediately.
Mr. Chair?
We have some. Representative Hass, is that your guest?
No, we do have somebody from AED.
Representative Greenlee?
Thank you. I'm really glad you guys are here because you know the most about it anybody in the building, and as you know, I supported this last time, but I do have a couple of questions, and I really appreciate it if you'd help clear it up. Let me give you a little bit of what a concern is, and the story that I just heard from North Plains gave me some addition to that concern. Using the defibrillator and then getting in the car and driving the patient to the hospital who had just obviously had VTAC. I mean, it seems to me the critical thing that we've trained people is to dial 911 and do it fast and do CPR. And I wonder whether you sense there's any danger of inexpertly fooling around with an external defibrillator for perhaps the correct indication, perhaps the wrong indication, and delaying getting help on the way as a part, and whether there are some downsides to folks. We know if we have in every school in the state, not everybody in the state, not every school will have somebody trained to use the device in a way that needs to be used and to assess the situation. I'm worried, and I don't know whether you've had any experience or any information with the sort of extra security this gives to allow people to move in the wrong direction in an emergency rather than in the right direction.
Mr. Chair, may I ask my question? Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I think the point is that we have to have people properly trained. I've been in situations, and I'm sure you have too, where we have an emergency with somebody down, and the first thing you're supposed to do before you do anything else is to say, call 911 and get help. The number of times I've seen people forget to do that is amazing. They're 5 or 10 minutes into CPR, and someone says, has anybody called yet? That's a matter of training. I think restricting yourself to saying we're not going to bring in a new tool in our tool bag because we don't follow proper protocol is a direction we shouldn't go. I think we should bring every tool we can as quickly as possible. But remember, we have a protocol to follow, and people need to be trained in that protocol. When someone's down, the first thing you do is you call. The second thing you do is check the airway. The third thing you do is check the heart. The fourth thing you do is having done those things and patient isn't responding after you've established CPR, you put the machine on. So, I mean, you've got to be trained in these protocols, and we can train those people. But to say we're not going to do this because we haven't done the training, I have a difficulty with that. We need to continue to train.
Yeah, follow up. I have just one more question. You know, you actually could write that. Mark, can you hold up that thing? I mean, you actually might want to have on the outside something that says call 911. It might be a very useful enterprise. The other question I have is a technical question. We talked last session about whether the same machine was appropriate for a child as for an adult. Is that issue been settled, or is it a non-issue?
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlee, I believe that's a non-issue at this point. I've not read any instances nor heard anything that makes me think we can't use it in all age groups. We used to be very concerned about the size and the shock people got by size and age. We now pretty well do 400 for everybody. I don't think it's an issue at this point. We're trying to save a life, and we have a machine that does it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee.
Mr. Chair, could I say one last thing?
Yes, please.
This is a bill that I think really reaches across partisan lines, and it's easy to get things partisan, and I hope that we can look past all that. I think that this is something that costs the state nothing. It simply asks that we look for funds for this, and it raises awareness. And I'm hoping this does not become in any way a partisan issue. This is something that Representative Hass and I have looked at for years. We really want this to come through. We have an exact copy of this bill coming from the Senate. I really don't care which one you guys act on. It doesn't matter to me. But please, give us one. Thank you.
Dr. Bates, I don't think healthcare is a partisan issue, and this is an important component. So I agree with you. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Representative Hess, could I ask you to maybe stick around for a few minutes? Or and there's Pam Brewer signed up.
Pam Brewer.
Good morning, welcome.
And I represent, I'm a sub-distributor for Phillips, but my passion is getting AEDs in schools where kids can be safe, and as we know, it's the chances of a child, it's going to be about 5% for a child to need one of these. But if they're in there, then that 5% for that parent, that grandparent, that child's life is huge, right? We all agree on that. So I just wanted to take a minute because I saw that Representative House had this unit to show you, and I wanted to show you one other thing, especially since most of the machines today on the market are designed to be as user-friendly as possible. And they're going to help that person to make sure that they call 911 because it's a prompt on the machine that reminds you to do that. They also teach you and coach you through CPR. And I don't know if you want to hear that to understand how simple they are to use. It would be a quick demonstration if you want. It's up to you. On the same hand, you know, he asked about whether these are used for children or not. In the last few years, the technology to make these readily available for children and to reduce the energy so that we're not putting a jolt that we would put in for an adult into a child. The technology that these machines have to detect whether it's a child, you know, we're going to put it on a child whether they're large or small because it's their last chance. If they're not breathing, they have no signs of circulation, no signs of life, this is their last hope. It may work, it may not. It may be that something else is going on, but at least we have a chance. I believe they're so simple to use. I know of a documented case where a family had a child with Parkinson's heart syndrome. They had a child that was 5 months old that was defibrillated with one of these units with pediatric caps. That child has a second chance of life. He was only 5.5 months old. I think that's a great testimonial. I'm using them at all ages. Would you like to hear the machine or not? I mean,
sure. Yeah.
It's pretty simple. This machine has sensors in it, so it'll keep up with me. I'm going to go quickly so that we can get through, so that you don't share. This is Matt. I bring him with me. He's my helper. He's got little silver pads on him.
I'll stick close.
That's where the electrodes have a chance to talk to each other. When I get the electrodes on, the machine has a circuit connected, and it makes it so that the machine will automatically start to analyze.
Insert pads cartridge. Adult training pads. Training. In case of emergency.
Tells us in case of emergency to put a real set of pads back in. This machine, as long as there's a battery in it, always wants to be ready.
Did we have him sign in?
Matt, get up there. Sign in.
He's talking.
He's out.
It's Peter Thomas, the voice of Nova.
Begin by removing all clothing from the patient's chest. Cut clothing if needed.
Okay, scissors are in here for doing that. Women, children, we all have to have clean, dry, bare chest.
When look carefully at the pictures on the white adhesive pads, peel one pad from the yellow plastic line.
So each pad tells us where it needs to go. I want to make sure, and it shows a bare chest. Okay.
Look carefully at the pictures on the white adhesive pads. Place pad exactly as shown in the picture. Press firmly to patient's bare skin.
I'm going to go ahead and put the next pad on because I know the prompt.
When the first pad is in place, look carefully at the picture on the second pad. Peel the second pad from the yellow plastic liner. Place pad. No one should touch the patient.
It's a caution light going right now. Tells us not to touch because that'll interrupt the ability to measure that heart rhythm.
Analyzing. Shock advised. Stay clear of patient.
Everyone stay
clear.
Press
the flashing orange button now. Shock delivered.
All it took.
No one should touch the patient. Analyzing.
You have to analyze again to see if it works.
Shock not advised.
Great.
Be sure emergency medical services have been called. It is safe to touch.
You got it at the beginning.
This could be programmed at the beginning as well.
Check circulation.
It's good. It can go either way or better.
For help, pinch nose, tilt head, and give two full breaths. Breathe. Place the heel of one hand in the center of the chest between the nipples. Place your other hand on top of the first. Push the chest down firmly 2 inches. Keep time with the beat. Pinch nose, tilt head, and give 2 full breaths. Breathe.
Okay, now that you're all calmed down. Smiley emotion charge now.
Continue with compression.
This would do this with you for 1 full minute if that's what you needed. Also, if you were confident and you were trained in your CPR and didn't feel you needed that pump, and you could get more compressions more quickly without listening to that, then you wouldn't have to press that. It would just count back to you in every 15-second intervals. We know that after giving 3 shocks, if we had to give 3 shocks, that we have to do CPR for 1 full minute, so the machines are designed to prompt you and default to that. They measure 4 different aspects of a rhythm to determine to make sure that it's an accurate rhythm that needs to be shocked or not. So, you know, the part where we want to make sure that we're shocking shockable rhythms and not shocking a non-shockable rhythm. Some of the machines on the market today have the ability to measure artifact, which means if somebody had a pacemaker in but their heart stopped, the pacemaker would still keep going. That can send a signal to a machine and it can get confused. But most of the machines today on the market have surpassed that, recognized that as a flaw that could cause a machine to deliver a no-shock message when there should be a shock delivery. So they're pretty infallible. When we talk about training, one of the places that we should look at, O'Hare, Chicago Airport. They've had, in a 23-month period when they first started their program, they had 29 instances where they were called to get their AEDs out. 19 of those were shockable situations. 7 of those were delivered by untrained people entirely. They had 13 saves in all. It's a pretty good record, we think. Much better than a 0 chance for all of us.
Okay. Thanks very much. Question.
How much do they cost?
What's great about all of these today, for the schools qualify for great discounts. Generally, schools are getting them for less than $1,000 for things like this. They range from about $1,200 for first responders, paramedics, those types, up to $3,500. There's a lot of technology that's gone into the pediatric capability. Most high schools and middle schools aren't going to need pediatric capability because we refer to pediatrics as ages 1 to 8 or up to 55 pounds. So where we would look for those, that pediatric issue is mostly in schools that have child care programs, early childhood development programs, or in the elementary schools. There are some machines now that have just a key that will slip in and it will turn the machine from adult to pediatric. And like when we listened to the prompt on CPR, it would give us prompt for children.
And quick follow-up. Do you make those the program available to volunteer fire departments?
Yes.
Okay, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for your time.
Colleagues, we have one person who we're still waiting on their arrival. So what I'll do is I will close the public hearings on these bills temporarily, and when that person arrives, we will reopen the public hearing. Did we miss anybody in the audience on this bill? No. Okay. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2358, close the public hearing on House Bill 2826, close the public hearing on House Bill 3059, and I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2752. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2752 requires that the Department of Human Services to develop programs to provide sponsorship services to specified elderly and disabled persons.
Okay, thanks very much. Mr. Bert Kopp.
Department of Ed, right? My name is Bertrand Kopp. I'm sponsoring this bill. There's considerable hesitancy whether some people feel it's... Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Bertrand Kopp. This bill is one that has been running around in people's minds quite a little bit in one form or another. And, I'm a little upset for the previous display of machines that talk. I think it's fabulous. The volunteer guardianship program, which was once run by the Mid Valley Senior Services Agency, was an attempt to do this. And I don't know, they didn't carry on very far because they didn't have separate funding for it. The goal is to keep people at home, out of courts, out of nursing homes, and off welfare. It's good for Oregon, it's good for the people too, they can maintain their lifestyles. Most people have a little bit of money tucked away for their old age, and if nothing happens to them, they can live pretty well. If you want to see what happens when it doesn't, flip over to page 3, the last page of your bill there, and look at the paragraph that I have blocked off there with brackets. And you can see what happens to a person's life savings once they get into a courthouse. They drain it away. Those people can never recover. They can't earn the money back. They probably will have to move out of their house and sell it to pay the bills. Their life is over as far as anybody is concerned. And worst of all, the courts never let go when they get a hold of somebody. Not until they've sucked away every dime. They will probably throw that person in a nursing home. They'd quickly die then, because who wouldn't die quickly in a nursing home? Then they get the estate. It's a form of entrapment, and which is criminal in the least. So I'm hoping that by providing people information at the right time, that they can step out of these problems and get help to get out of problems by having pro bono legal services available to them to stop people encroaching on them through loan sharking, foreclosures. They don't know how to take out bankruptcy type 13 to stop themselves being foreclosed out of houses. And I hope with this program we can provide them help to keep them in their houses. On the second page of your handout there, you'll see a story about somebody who thought a will would take care of their estate. Wrong. As this lady found out, a will doesn't. A will only handles residuals. And when you have something already made out in two names, it's not going through a court. It's going directly to the other person. And advice like this is the kind of thing a person needs to get out there. Very few people think of estate planning until it's too late. Then somebody who probably hasn't ever handled money or really knows what they're doing is left with the problems of carrying on. And I have a program, have a little thing I wrote up here. What do I do now? It's a collection of common knowledge, but not legal advice, to people who have recently lost a family member and haven't got a clue of what to do next. Where do you record the death? How do you collect benefits? How do you transfer property? And so on. I don't dare hand that out because I'd be sued for legal advice without a license. But if the Human Services Department has a legal umbrella like sponsorship program, they can put these in every area of office, area aging office. They can go to every senior center. Because I ask people, do you know the difference between probate property and non-probate property? How many of you know that? I'll bet it's less than 50%. Probate property is one that has no established line of succession, like a bank account with only one name on it. If there's two names on it, it's non-probate property. It automatically goes to the other person and doesn't go through a court. If it goes to a court, it becomes public knowledge. All the crooks and shysters and all the disinherited relatives, all the grieving creditors are in there reading what is in the court record. And if you think they don't do it, I got news for you, they do. So in my proposal to do this, I'm suggesting that this be made a two-year trial program. If it proves to be the advantage to the Department of Human Services, it can be extended. Presently, I haven't had a lot of positive feedback from them. They feel it would cost money. Well, actually, it doesn't. It doesn't cost one dime. It doesn't require one desk, one even letterhead, because this is just something that empowers them to do what they can do otherwise without getting sued. They have volunteers work for them. The benefit of having a volunteer work for you is, of course, zero pay. But they can also use the situation to abuse the other person. If they're under the sponsorship program, the state of Oregon can sue and recover money. They can be fired if they aren't suitable also. That can't be done. The individual who has been wronged has to have somebody go to bat with them and take them to court. And sometimes they're not capable of it. So that's the advantage of having them under a sponsorship program. The other one, of course, is if someone tries to advise somebody, oh, don't give any more checks to your son-in-law, you need that money to pay your expenses. The result is they're sued by the son-in-law. This DH, the Department of Human Services, can come along and say, oh, that person is under the sponsorship program. If you want to sue anybody, sue the state of Oregon. We'll defend them. Meanwhile, we report you to the Elder Abuse Committee and see if we can't put you in prison. The program Stolen Lives appeared, Stolen Lives appeared in the AARP magazine a year ago. And it details thousands of people being ripped off, their lives destroyed by fraudulent guardianships. That's why I'm doing this. Let's keep them at home. Let's keep them on their own. I know of cases I've helped do with myself, and there needs to be other people doing it. It would help if somebody would establish this program. And I remember one program, one situation in the city of Independence where my neighbor got a phone call from the church. A lady was looking for some wood. She had no more money to buy wood. Is there anybody have any wood they could give her? Well, my neighbor took a pickup load down there, came back shaking his head. The lady was living in an old garage. Her husband had died. Her house had burned down, and she's living in a vine-covered, moss-covered old piece of junk out back. She's got a little stove in there and a little bunk. That's how she's living, if you can call that living. If a sponsor had been available, so I could have told her, now look, the Department of Agriculture has subsidized apartments right here in town. The rent is one-fourth of your income, period. The rest is subsidized. They're clean, nice apartments. I've seen them myself. You have money in the real estate you still own. With those two combinations, you can have a comfortable life. No trips to Paris, but you don't have to live in an overgrown garage. It's these kind of situations that call for somebody like a sponsor that somebody can call when they need some help. Because most people never think about the hereafter until they're there. And so to provide this advice costs virtually nothing. And it's limited to people who have nobody else to help them. If you wish to try this on a two-year trial basis, it would be probably an advantage. It doesn't have to be carried on if the DHS cannot find a reason for getting an advantage out of it. Personally, I think if they think about it a little bit, it could help them quite a bit because of the legal shield it puts over them. By the way, I would like to point out from the previous thing the futility of calling 911. I had a chance to do this several times for my parents. The ambulance never arrived within 20 minutes. Most every time I had to call a dispatcher, find out where the ambulance was, and have them redirected back to my place, because they'd always drive right past it and go out into the boondocks. and it was always at least 20 minutes. And my neighbor, excuse me, one of my friends, called 911. Ambulance in the ride for 2 hours. And, of course, the guy's dead. So don't depend on 911.
Okay. You need to wrap up your comments, please.
I think I've explained what I'm trying to do here. Do you have any questions?
Are there questions from the panel? Representative Anderson.
Just one brief question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We appreciate your concern and interest in kind of providing an ombudsman for people that really need some good advice. We have a lot of standardization and certification in financial counseling. What was your intent? To put people in contact with a certified counselor or to be providing financial information?
The financial information I wasn't going to include, unless, of course, we have some writings, which I also have on estate planning, which is handouts. This is to provide them someone to talk to. The picture you see on this cover here is obviously someone who is a bit overwrought with situations, and someone's there to comfort her and point out the way. The certification, it was not intended to be included. These are people who are usually volunteers.
Yeah.
I mean, some of these people just drive people to doctor's appointments, for instance. They hear stories like, oh, did you hear about Louise? She hasn't any money left. What happened to Louise? Oh, her... Right. Somebody took it.
So you're mainly interested in...
So that person can then say, okay, I know where there's a pro bono lawyer that'll help put a stop to this and maybe recover your money.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2752 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2707. Ask Representative Greenlake to introduce this measure to us. You want to take the stand, if you would?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Haas, we'll clear this bill, and then we'll get to you next. Thanks.
Chair and committee members, thank you for hearing this bill. 2707 began its life in the last session as a result of the reorganization of DHS and the observation by many of us in the public health field, and in fact by many in DHS, that public health had gotten hopelessly lost in the reorganization. We talked about it again in the interim committee that you chaired, Representative Velto, and the governor's position was that he wasn't prepared at this time to pull PHS out of DHS, but instructed the DHS director to work with our committee and with the public health community to bring the public health function into more a clearer state in the Department of DHS. We had a work group that worked through much of the interim and came almost to where we needed to come and reported to the interim committee, the interim joint committee, on the fact that we had created a position of director of public health. The public health functions had been moved under that director. Recruitment had begun, and we were still not quite in agreement on how that public health position would report. I think the task force had decided that a compromise model would be we would put away this position if the public health director reported directly to the director of DHS. It didn't quite work out that way with a sort of convoluted organizational chart that caused me some problems and others some problems with the director reporting in a dual relationship through Barry Cass, the head of the health cluster, and for policy issues to the director. That caused Senator Gordley and I, as we expressed at the in the interim committee, to reintroduce the bill to create a separate Department of Public Health, but to use it to monitor the situation, to see how the recruitment was coming, and to see whether we could clarify that reporting relationship within the department. We'll hear testimony shortly from the deputy director of the department. The recruitment was successful. We recruited a very able candidate who I think we may hear from today. And there have been some other announced resignations and retirements within the DHS. This week, DHS and I reached an agreement that they would clarify, and they'll be testifying, that they would clarify that reporting relationship, that the director would report directly to the director of DHS. And if we're satisfied that that is going to happen, and we'll hear that testimony, then I think we won't need further action on this bill at that time.
Okay.
Thanks, Representative. Cindy Becker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cindy Becker, Deputy Director of the Department of Human Services, otherwise known as the last person standing.
Shut out the lights.
I just had to say that. Representative Greenlick, we have talked, and as he said, we have hired a new public health director, Dr. Susan Allen, who has a Master's of Public Health, a doctorate. She's an MD, a Master of Public Health, and a lawyer. All rolled into one. And came from Virginia. She has incredible experience, particularly in the area of public health preparedness because of all the various disaster that happened in that area. So she is coming with a lot of good experience for us. We certainly hope that we never experience it, but we're very pleased. And she's already taken over public health and done a terrific job. As Representative Greenlick said, she is reporting to the director of the Department of Human Services. I know that was a concern of Representative Greenlick. She has also has a lot of support from the Conference of Local Health Officials. She's already established a working relationship with them. And we think by public health having an identity within the department that is overseen by Dr. Allen and Dr. Allen reporting to the director, we hope that that does resolve some of the issues that Representative Greenlick and Senator Gordley raised. And we're very pleased to have her, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here on House Bill 2707? Seeing nobody, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2707, and we will open a public hearing on 2712. Wait. I'm sorry. 2358. Representative Hass.
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you again. Mark Hass, House District 27. I would like to introduce you to Tina Johnson of Portland. She has some things on her heart she would like to share with you.
Welcome to Hot. Officially, it's Christine Johnson, but everybody calls me Tina. Thank you for hearing me today. I'm here because this bill is very important to me, and it's kind of after the fact for me because about 8 weeks ago today, I lost my son playing basketball in an interscholastic basketball gang. And it's kind of hard because the grief is just now starting to hit me because I was so busy in the beginning. But so you know who I'm talking about, and he's not just a statistic, this is Eddie. I wanted to show him to you. He wasn't just a basketball player, he was a good friend and very good student. No alcohol, no drugs, no problems. And he had lots of friends. At his memorial, there was over 1,500 people, so we had to hold it at the University of Portland Child Center. And I believe Eddie, from all the records that I'm getting now, is showing that Eddie died of heart failure. And if an AED had been available, I believe he would have had a chance to survive. But because of the response time with the defibrillator, it was lessened each moment that went by. And I just believe that all schools, I mean, even before this happened, I couldn't figure out why they didn't have something available at the schools in case of, I mean, it could have been a fan, a coach, anybody. And I just heard recently in the news where a man in, I forgot where it was at the time, but just recently, lost consciousness, and they had an AED on site, and he was on the news talking the next day. So it's kind of bittersweet for me when I hear about these things, and I just believe that they should be available. Even if they don't save the person, to know that the family, to know that there was everything done possibly to make that effort. So I'm asking that you guys really take this bill seriously, vote on it, move it through, and make it a law so that it's mandatory that these schools carry, are required to have these units on site. And also, just to, you know, because it's such a passion for me, I have been trying to raise money on my own, which I did, and donated some to the places where Eddie played basketball and where his heart was, so to speak. So that's it. Thank you.
Thanks very much for coming down.
Thank you.
Questions or comments right now?
Mr. Chair, if I may. We really thank you for coming down. I have three granddaughters at Grant, and I can add to the test what kind of a shock that was to the school community, how respected and admired your son was, and how it, this kind of an event isn't just about you and your family, it's about the whole school family, in this case 3,000 other children who were very much involved in that. And we really do appreciate you coming down to talk to us today.
Thank you.
That's a beautiful boy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
How old was Eddie?
16.
Very young. Thank you so much for coming.
Okay. Thanks very much.
I like that.
Okay, we'll close the house. We're public hearing on House Bill 2358, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2712. This is a bill that prohibits the insurance pool governing board from imposing a period of uninsurance for an applicant to qualify for FEOP if the applicant's family includes dependent children. Representative Greenlich is going to introduce us to this measure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, thank you for holding this hearing. The Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, FEOP, has two components. It has a component of the group side where group employers can help participate in the program by providing benefits that are counted with general fund revenues to create a Medicaid match. The importance of FEOP, both in the group and on the individual basis, is it allows us to get Medicaid match for providing health insurance for poor folks who might not otherwise qualify for OHP, especially for OHP standard, but it still allows us to increase the health insurance pool. This bill and the next bill you're going to hear is about trying to do what we can in a sort of stopgap way to increase the coverage of health insurance to the members of our population. We have nearly 20% of our population uncovered by health insurance, and a full 2/3 of those people are fully employed. FEOP and the discussion we'll have on 2753 both help provide people, I mean, both help allow people to get their own insurance provided, many times with them making a contribution, but still allow us to bring Medicaid match into the state to help do this. As we developed FEOP, we were worried that the population would be overextended. We had a specific target population that we wanted to cover, and because of that, in establishing priorities, we established a priority that folks that had not had health insurance for the last 6 months should be excluded. It's clear that's not a problem now, at least in the group plan, although we may hear from Mr. King about I'm not sure whether he's scheduled to testify on this or not, but we have not, I think, achieved that target. So it seemed clear to me and to others that have been looking at this problem that we ought to take away that six-month waiting period and make sure that folks that otherwise don't have the ability to get health insurance can get this under the FEOP program, which has the advantage of leveraging private money, general fund money, and Medicaid money to help provide that coverage. Mr. Chair, I've been asked to provide an amendment to this bill, and I am preparing an amendment for it that will also take away the same six-month waiting period for the Children's Health Insurance Program based on the same model. We have less than 50% of eligible kids covered under CHIP. It's a terrific program. We get, I think it's a 25 to 75 match on CHIP, and I'm not sure in that case where that six-month waiting period came, so I will be preparing a set of Dash 1 amendments. I ask you to hold a work session on this bill. I think it provides the opportunity both to bring more federal dollars into the state, something I'm always looking to do, but more importantly, the opportunity to help folks with limited means provide health insurance for themselves and their families. This would only apply the removal of the six-month exclusion to families that have dependent children less than 23 years of age in their home, not the other family. So it seems a modest extension to move this forward.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Greenlee. Okay, Representative Broome.
No, just a comment. I really like that, Representative Greenlee, and I fully support it. Kind of thinking about my bill that has to do with FEOP, too, and wondering how we can incorporate those together. So thank you very much for doing that. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, sir.
I don't see anybody else signed up. Is there anybody in the audience that wants to testify on this bill? Okay. Yeah, come on up.
For the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator of the Insurance Pool Governing Board and the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. And just a point of clarification so that there's no misunderstanding, federal regulations require a period of uninsurance for the use of the Title 21 funds for both CHIP and for FEOP. However, whether that period of uninsurance is 6 months or 1 day, I think is subject to what the state may propose to the federal government. So if this bill were to pass, we would be required then to make a amendment to our waiver that we have with the federal government requesting permission to alter that date. There is another state, and I can't recall which one, that has a zero period of uninsurance under the same Title 21 regulation. So I just want to make sure that we understand that we would have to go forward to the federal government to make sure that they agreed with an alteration or a change to our period of uninsurance.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, Representative May.
Rocky, how long would it take to get that permission from the federal government?
Ms. Chair, Representative Tomei, I'm not sure whether that's 2 months or 6 months, but I just have not been through an amendment process, quite frankly, so I can't answer that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, you're welcome. Okay, thanks very much. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2712 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2753. Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I didn't announce for the record who I was in the last hearing. I will announce for the record in this hearing. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlee, House District 33. And perhaps we can amend the record of the other two hearings I've testified on today to include that. I apologize. Let me make sure I get the numbers right. Okay, House Bill 2753 was a much more difficult choice for me than the prior bill, which seemed pretty obvious to ask for that waiver. When then Representative Monis Anderson and Representative Verger introduced in the House in the last session a bill to increase the coverage of for small businesses, to make it easier for small businesses to get a stripped-down version of health insurance, I voted against it in the first discussion, because I was worried that this would dilute the soup sufficiently that providing coverage that was stripped down in small businesses would take away from the willingness of small businesses to provide better health insurance that included mandates, health insurance that was more comprehensive. The bill came out of the House and over to the Senate, was reworked in the Senate, and came back to the House, and almost everybody then voted for it as it came back in its modified form. But in its modified form, it still had the requirement that the program, the state program, could not be offered to businesses that was at the time of the passage of the bill providing health insurance for its employees. I struggled with that, and I became particularly alarmed in the period since the end of the last session and the beginning of this session, with some data that I kept hearing about, talking about the proportion of small businesses offering health insurance to its employees, that proportion was plummeting. I haven't been able to put my hands on the specific data for testimony today, but I became very, very concerned with that. I am worried about the uninsurance rate in Oregon, and I began hearing from small businesses in my community, my constituents, who said, as a small business owner, with the rising health insurance premiums as it stood now, they only had two choices: keep the more complete health insurance intact, eat up in some way the 15 to 20% per year rate increases that were coming as a part of that, and take that money out of other employee benefits or wages or employees. That was one choice. The other choice was to drop health insurance. And more and more of them, they were telling me, when faced with that choice, were dropping health insurance. That got me to rethink this balance, the question between making sure that when a small business provided health insurance, it provided it a comprehensive form of health insurance, or trying to maximize the opportunity for small businesses to provide health insurance, even a stripped-down version of health insurance, for their employees. And I decided, and this balance is something that I've struggled with as a health policy person over the 40 years of my health policy career, I decided in the interim to come down on the other side and to provide the opportunity to maximize the opportunity for small businesses to provide at least a basic form of health insurance for their employees. This bill essentially removes Section 2B of Chapter 742 of the Oregon Laws of 2003. And that Section 2B says, health benefit plans for small employers offered by the Insurance Pool Governing Board under ORS 35710 sub 8 that are not eligible for a subsidy under ORS 735724 may be offered only to small employers that did not provide a health insurance benefit plan for eligible employees on July 1st, 2003, and to small employers that began business on or after the effective date of this 2003 Act. We're now about 2 years beyond that 2003 deadline, and my fear is that more and more employers have or are about to drop their current coverage without the opportunity to move to this more efficient or actually more stripped down but less expensive form of health insurance. So, Mr. Chair, I'm asking you to consider this. I think you'll hear some testimony today on both sides of this issue, because there's in fact not a single true answer. This is a balancing question, and the question is, where does the balance tip? As I say, I've changed my position, and the balance for me has tipped to trying to maximize the ability of the small employers to provide health insurance for their employees. Thank you very much, sir.
Well, there's a couple other bills I'd like you to change your position on.
Ms. Cruz, I have an open mind. I'll trade you one for one.
All right. Representative Cameron.
Representative Greenlick, you know, when I first got here that I came to you and talked to you about this issue, and I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think it's an extremely important issue for small businesses and for the people of the state of Oregon that work in those businesses, employees. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Next on the list is J.L. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, J.L. Wilson, representing NFIB. I do have 12,000 small employers in the state of Oregon and would like to express my gratitude to Representative Greenlick for his proposal. I do consider it the single most important piece of legislation for small business in terms of extending affordable health coverage to them, or at least giving them the opportunity to purchase affordable health coverage. The bill that Representative Greenlick alluded to last session, House Bill 2537, at the behest of Representative Berger and then Representative Monis Anderson, asked the IPGB to create a health benefit plan. It was a pared-down base level plan. They have done so. It saves roughly 30% on premium that was put to market less than 2 months ago. Now, as part of that compromise, as the representative alluded to, that benefit plan was available only to small companies who were newly formed as of July 1, 2003 or later, or companies that did not have extend health benefits to their employees as of July 1, 2003. That is just something that we had to swallow. That's politics. You get half wins all the time. You take what you like and swallow what you don't and hope to work on the next piece in future sessions. We consider this the next piece. That is, it did not make sense to us to have a plan like this and not maximize its impact by extending it to as many small employers. Now, when I'm talking about small employers, please understand that the benefit plan created by the IPGB is for employers with 2 to 50 employees, those who are in the small group market. So this doesn't go to the Walmarts of the world. This is for those who employ 2 to 50 here in the state of Oregon. And we consider that the problem of uninsurance in this state is largely the problem of small business. Representative Greenlick was right, and perhaps he heard what we found in our own internal surveys with among our membership, which was about 5-6 years ago. We had health coverage, or the percentage of employers in our organization offering health benefits about 6 years ago was 70% of our employers, and today it's 60%. And in that same time, what we've found is roughly one-fifth, less than one-fifth of our members on any given year are able to keep their cost increases under 10%.
which means 80% of our members see cost increases exceeding 10% on an annual basis. And it's just hard to keep up with that. And so in light of that, it makes sense to create the IPGB plan, and to us it makes sense to extend that to as many small employers as possible. And that's why we are so wholeheartedly behind House Bill 2753. It should also be noted that as part of the original bill, House Bill 2537, there was a sunset on the bill. And the sunset was in 4 years, which is 2 years from now. And the reason for that sunset was to allow DCBS, I believe it was DCBS, to do a series of data accumulation, figure out who was accessing this plan, whether there was a gravitation from employers to one plan, to this base level plan. It was basically allow a 4 year period of data collection. My suggestion to you, to allay any concerns about this, to this bill, is we would be perfectly fine, keeping a sunset in place, for purposes of data accumulation and figuring out the demographics and who gravitates toward this plan, keeping a sunset in place on this bill. It could be 2 years, it could be 4 years. The period of time really doesn't matter to us. But I would hope that it would at least give a period of time where all small employers in the 2 to 50 group market could access this plan and allay some concerns that perhaps an undue number of employers will access this plan who might otherwise have a richer benefits package. There's got to be a balance somewhere in there. I'm so pleased that Representative Greenlick is looking for that, and we're happy to help in that capacity too.
Thank you, Representative Mann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wilson, what is the cost, basic premium cost, on the program that was just released?
Well, thank you, Chair Dalto and Representative Anderson. Mr. King can probably give you better numbers, but costs are different in counties. We found that in Southern Oregon, in your district, Josephine and Jackson County, you probably have the highest costs. If you're going to insure a full family, probably you're looking at $1,100 a month. Here in Marion County, I would say it's $900 to $1,000 a month. The program designed by the IPGB had a goal in mind of saving a minimum of 30% on premium. That was the number that was targeted as actually making an impact where employers would look at that as an attractive option in the marketplace. But I don't have those specific numbers, but you get the general framework.
Okay. Thanks very much. Next, I would like to invite John Powell, Kim Wirtz, and Mark Nelson forward. I believe that bracket is there to bring you up as a panel. All right.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell. Before you today, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, and with me is Kim Wirtz, an employee of Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, I just might ask about your time for our testimony.
Yeah, I'd like to wrap up by about 10:30, so we have a little bit of time.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it pains me to be before you on the same side of this issue with the king of mandates, Mr. Nelson. But so be it, for at least a few hours we're on the same page. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we share Representative Greenlick's concern for the uninsured. We think it is a huge problem and a growing problem. We do, however, disagree on the effect of this bill and using this particular amendment to the law to get there. And let me tell you why. The reforms that have passed in the Oregon system require, I think, a lot of discipline on the part of policymakers to stay within the conforms and the confines of those reforms. With individual insurance, if somebody tries to get an individual insurance policy and they do not qualify for reasons of their health and pre-existing conditions, The Oregon system provides insurance on a guaranteed issue basis for those people in the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. That pool is currently written at a very small percentage above what any healthy person could get an individual policy for. I think there's about a 6% or so surcharge in the premium to those people. So every single Oregonian has access to health insurance. Obviously, there's one barrier, and that's cost. In the small group market, the Oregon system requires that health insurers writing insurance for small groups do it on a guaranteed issue basis. That is, a group of 250 comes to Regents or to ODS or to HealthNet. We are required under the law to sell them a policy and to pool those risks in a large small group pool. Large groups above 50 have historically and continue not to have trouble getting competitive bids, or they self-insure. So currently in this system of guaranteed issue on both individual policies and small group policies, one then has to be careful as to how you allow people to go from one product to another in terms of selection based on their own health and their small group's health. This bill would basically allow a small group to move to the insurance pool governing board product, which has been described accurately as being about 30% cheaper, because it carries for the adult population that product no chemical dependency or mental health benefits. It carries a $50,000 maximum first 2 year benefit, and then it goes to a $500,000 lifetime benefit. Most commercial insurance policies today have a $2 million lifetime benefit. Some still have $1 million, but most have been moved up to $2 million. So under the provisions of House Bill 2753, a small employer could buy this product, enjoy the savings, and then if they are a spouse or children, or an employee's spouse or children, or the employee developed problem not covered or needing higher lifetime benefits, they could walk into an insurance company and demand a small group policy based on guaranteed issue. And that insurance company would have to write that policy. So allowing younger, healthier lives to move out of that pool of small employers currently into another product, cheaper product for a time, but then allowing them to go back at their will have the effect over time of removing premium from that pool, leaving those who can't leave it because of health conditions or whatever to pay ever higher and escalating prices. So the discipline, when we have these, what I think we can all agree are good social policies of saying everybody can get health insurance in Oregon, but it requires some discipline in protecting those pools so that the healthy lives don't step out until they need it and come back only when they need it. It would be very similar to allowing a person on an individual policy just to walk in after the disease strikes. And we have an element of that system in our guaranteed issue system with individuals going to the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. What I didn't tell you about the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool is that health insurers are assessed on a semi-annual basis to subsidize that pool because people have that luxury of basically waiting until they're ill to go get their their insurance. The house is on fire, you go buy the insurance policy. That's a large subsidy, and I can't remember exactly. I think the last semiannual assessment was $17 million. So at that rate, it would be about $34 million a year. Health insurers are assessed to subsidize that pool because of, basically, of that luxury. So we don't want to see other pools experience that same kind of an escalation in cost. There are other mechanisms and other policy decisions that the legislature could make to open the market up to other forms, other types of products that are less expensive. But it is somewhat ironic that I give my colleague a bad time. We stand here on the precipice of adopting mental health parity and then consider a bill that would allow you to have no mental health coverage. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members, I hope I didn't go on too long. Kim's here because she has some specialty in this particular market area and was active in working with the Insurance Pool Governing Board in developing this product. There's only two insurers that are selling this product, Regents and Health Net, as was stated, that is just that product just hit the marketplace. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Cameron.
Maybe you just clarified my question. Can you sell this product? Can Regency sell this product that we're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, yes. We are one of two participating carriers.
And is it open to other carriers if they wish to apply?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Cameron, I believe that all carriers were probably offered an opportunity to do it.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative May.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I just want to make sure that I've understood what you said. So you think that this bill would have a detrimental effect on the overall health insurance, that when people, I just want to make sure I understand you, that when people are healthy, they may buy into this one, which would be 30% less costly. And then if they develop an illness, then they can go into the other insurance, which is more expensive. But when by taking them out when they're healthy, you, what is it? They don't contribute to the bigger and pool is what I guess I'm looking for. So when they don't, when they're healthy and they don't contribute to the bigger pool, then it leaves the smaller, and so it's going to be more expensive than the other policies. Am I sort of understanding that? Okay. And the other thing is, tell me what mandates will not be covered in these two policies that are offered by Regents, and what is the other one?
HealthNet. Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, there is a benefit summary. I don't know. I think Mr. Nelson has it. And I'll let Kim Wirtz from Regents respond to that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei. The services not covered under the alternative adult plan includes dental benefits, immunizations, mental health and chemical dependency, both on an inpatient and an outpatient basis, vision benefits, and any well baby or well child benefits. Those are specifically excluded from this program. Additionally, I think it's important to note that this plan, the benefit design, shrinks some of the standard levels of benefit coverage for the covered services that we're all used to seeing in regular benefits. Oftentimes, again, John referred to the limitations of $50,000 worth of benefits for the first 2 years of coverage and then a lifetime maximum benefit of $500,000, and then some fairly significant deductible and cost-sharing co-insurance amounts. So it is a dramatically smaller benefit package, and I think the concern that we have is the downstream effect to the existing small group market could basically create much higher increases than Mr. Wilson testified about that they've been seeing, again, based on the healthy people removing themselves and paying a lower premium until the time that they need the more comprehensive services. And that's the concern that we have. Certainly, Regents would never suggest that we would prefer less people to be covered. We're always interested in increasing and improving the number of insured Oregonians.
If I may follow, it from what I'm understanding then, though, so rather than decreasing premiums for everybody, this would actually increase premiums for the larger group, as I understand it, because the people, as they get ill in this small group, as they need more coverage, they would go into the larger group, and so it caused everybody's insurance premium to go up. That's and if I may follow up once more, so are you familiar with Senate Bill 1 that I think has passed the Senate?
The mental health parity bill?
Right. So how would that bill, if it were passed in both houses and signed by the governor, how would that mandate affect this bill?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, our understanding is that mandate would not apply to this particular program, so there would continue to be no mental health benefits or chemical dependency benefits under this program for either inpatient or outpatient services.
Follow-up. So if people need mental health and chemical dependency, they would opt out of this program and go into a program that would cover those benefits? Is that
that's true? That's typical buying patterns of small employers. I think another concern we have is that an employer might be enticed with the lower premium rate, not necessarily taking into consideration the benefit needs of all of the employees or their own family members. They do tend to, but they don't always have information about the health status of the dependents of their employees. And they might make that decision if they're already insured and covering those people, providing them with a more comprehensive level of benefits, choosing a lower premium plan that seriously diminishes or decreases the benefits available to those people could be devastating to some families.
Mr. Chair, I don't know. I see that Angela Kimball is here, and she signed up. Great, because I think we need to look at the effects that might have on the coverage of people in this program.
President Broome?
And I have a related question, I guess, then, as far as we're seeing evidence that cost, especially with the PEB program, that Public Employees Benefit Plan, that the cost to include mental health coverage is not very expensive, and it isn't reflecting the huge increases we've been told by a couple of the groups, and including NFIB. And so I've been waiting to hear from people for proof of what those costs really are, and what we're hearing from the PEB is that it's less than 1% increase. And so I'm wondering why that particular coverage wouldn't be included, because it is included for children, and the children's coverage on this plan for both it's mental health, chemical dependency, both inpatient and outpatient are offered for children, but not for the adults. So I don't understand the disparity there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boone, this isn't the proper forum to argue the mental health parity bill.
Yeah, however, first of all, we're going a little far afield. Yeah. I want to stick to this bill. We have 8 minutes left.
I would just simply say for the record that the PEB experience and the cost increase due to them going to parity is different than the cost increase to the general public and the general policyholder will be. And the reason for that is PEB had already purchased parity in chemical dependency and alcohol treatment prior to going to parity, and they had bought up the mental health benefit beyond the current mandated level. So the 0.4 or roughly 0.5% that they experienced in their first year increase was on a base that was much, much higher than the current mandated level of those benefits. So the benefit cost increase or claims cost increase to the average purchaser of health insurance for that bill will be more like 2.5%. So that I just wanted to clarify that for an understanding, not to get into a debate with
still
Mr. Nelson
still right now. Close.
Right now. Representative Greenlee had a question.
Yes, I'd like to ask a couple of questions of Regency. My understanding is that you offer a small group guaranteed issue plan. Can you tell me what the numbers in that group have been for, say, 2003, 2004, 2005, in terms of the number of people in that group?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, I don't have any specific figures with me, but I think we have seen the decline in small group business over several years, again, because of increasing costs, although we feel that we're turning the corner with that.
How big a decline has it been, roughly?
I don't have any statistical figures with me. We certainly could get those for you.
I'd really appreciate that. And one follow-up question, Martha. Can you tell me what the rate increases for that guaranteed issue small group has been in 2003, 2004, 2005?
We'll need to get that to you with this.
Have they been more than 15% on average?
I'm not positive.
My impression is that they've been more than 15% a year compounded over those years, but it would be very useful if you made available to the committee the extent to which you've had a serious decline in membership in your small group guaranteed coverage, to which there is already flight even under this bill, and we could project that flight will continue, and that would be useful. And the rate increases that you've experienced in 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, and are projecting for next year.
And Mr. Chairman and Representative Greenlake, that is, and as I testified, there are other mechanisms to bring, I think, some cost relief to the purchasers of health insurance. And it would most likely be in that particular market area where, again, from the rating standpoint, from insurers, we're very highly regulated and very limited in terms of offerings we can propose. So if all insurers offering small group could offer a more limited...
A stripped-down version, say, without mandates, for example.
Or with some combination of limitations, that would apply to the broader population. That would probably be the methodology to use to get to where you're going.
If I may follow, so then your argument is we shouldn't provide a stripped down version under the state plan because you'd prefer to provide a stripped down version under your own plan? Is that what you just said?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlake, obviously, as I testified, Regents participates in both programs. We think it's important to protect the integrity of the CHI or small employer health insurance pool.
I do too.
Thank you, Mr.
You're welcome, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I would ask both of you if this policy, which has been available, I guess, just a short time, but if it is selling well, I think a similar bills or similar policies have been available in other states, and how well do those sell?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, I'm not aware of experience in other states. Very few states have had the models that Oregon has had over the period of time. Washington State drove their system over a cliff and has had to totally reform it in the last 5 years.
Can you say system you're referring to?
Their health insurance system.
Okay.
And so I don't know that there's an apples-to-apples comparison in terms of how the system actually works. Washington, for a period of time, had very limited markets available to small employers and individuals due to the fact that their reforms did offer guaranteed issue to groups of one, for example. And again, people will buy based on their own individual circumstances, and they will come in and out of a market like that when they need it. In fact, a letter was a bill that's in a different committee was argued that a LifeWise insurance company representative read a letter from a woman who said, I really like your health plan, paid all my maternity bills right on time. I was 7 months pregnant when I bought it. By this letter, I would ask you to cancel my policy. But if I ever get pregnant again, I'll come right back to you. And, you know, at $10,000 of delivery, it doesn't take long to erode 3 months of premium to get there. And that is the problem with their system. So we can't compare in some cases. We can do some research to see if we can find what's happened in other jurisdictions.
And in this state, has this been a popular policy since it's been available?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, this has just been released within the last 2 months, and I will tell you that we've had limited sales, but lots of interest. So we're doing a lot of outreach cooperatively with Rocky King's team. Thank you.
Last question, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I came to the legislature, probably the main concern I had was in getting reasonable insurance for employers in the small business area. I'm a little disconcerted to hear that an employer with 50 employees or close to it might have to be paying out $50,000 a month in health care premiums. That, if that's what I understand, that's a real burden. And I'm particularly disturbed, and I signed on to this bill, but I guess it shows you that you need to know all the facts before you really come down on your final decision, which I will. But I'm concerned that this switching that you're talking about might be a major problem. If we're talking, as we have with nursing home care, with contractors and others, that we have only two providers at this point, I don't want to see those two reduce their insurance because of a major problem. Is there a way that you could limit the switching, possibly by having a short period of non-coverage? We basically wrote out any new employers that didn't have insurance or one or two other provisions. Is there a way to reduce that to say 30 days of non-coverage so that people don't just automatically switch?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, I don't know how you could restrict them from moving in and out of one system to another. You could say you have 30 days in order to qualify for this program. You have to be uninsured for 30 days or 6 months or 3 months. And that would definitely limit people moving back into this process unless they wanted to give up coverage for that period of time. And that would be helpful in limiting that transpiration. But it would not prevent people from going to this product first and then buying up.
Representative Cameron.
Oh, I'm there's going to be plenty of time.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing the Oregon Society of Clinical Social Workers. And Mr. Powell is correct. I've, for about 20 years, have been a proponent of mental health parity and have supported the alcohol and drug and chemical dispensing and mental health coverages. This particular bill is brought you today, I think, for all the right reasons, trying to solve a problem that we all know is there in terms of access to the health insurance. We do believe, however, that it causes some perhaps unknown consequences that we don't anticipate. As originally written, this legislation was designed to provide a low-cost package to uninsured employers, small employers. That was the entire purpose. There was an amendment in the bill originally which required that you could not enter this program unless you were uninsured for 1 year. And that would prevent the dumping down from regular policies into this product and causing the kinds of problems that that Regents has outlined today. Now, Regents has their reason for opposing it. Our reasons are clear, is that we don't want people to dump down from mental health and alcohol dependency coverage into a product in which that coverage is not there. So clearly, you know, we have both, I think, very good reasons for opposing this. The list I provided for you provides those mandates that are in statute now, and as has been indicated previously, chemical dependency and mental health is not available in these packages for adults. It is available for children. And I've given you a copy of the measure and I think you do have that, that I provided, I believe staff provided it. And you can see there under 2B what is being eliminated. And it says health benefit plans may be offered only to small employers that did not provide a health benefit plan for eligible employees on July 1, 2003. And to small employers that began business operations on or after. So new businesses could come into the program because that's the purpose. Let's help small businesses who are uninsured, bring them into in some basic level of coverage. Now clearly, as we get farther and farther from July 1, 2003, we're really talking now about a two-year period of time that you have to have been uninsured before you can come into the program. And I agree that, this limit should be probably brought back to the one-year situation. But what happens then is if this measure is eliminated, all small employers who are currently insured and under group insurance can literally look at these two packages and say, I want to cut my cost. And they can, you know, cut, as you've heard, 30%. And they will bounce down into that other policy. And I agree that the costs have gone up in the last 3 years. But those 10 to 15% increases are not the result of mandates. They're results of a multitude of issues involving the whole health insurance product. We haven't passed any major mandates in the last 2 or 3 years. But what are we doing in terms of taking those people who do have mental health coverage and alcohol dependency coverage now? We're allowing those employers to bounce down into this in which that will not be provided. And there is study after study after study that says with no mental health coverage, physical health coverage goes up anywhere from, or cost anywhere from 25 to 50%. Dozens of studies. With no mental health coverage, that's your impact. So we believe that to do this, in addition to the reasons that Mr. Powell has outlined, to do this is only going to increase cost, not just for the reason Mr. Powell have indicated, but for the lack of the mental health coverage, because people end up using their physical health side rather than going after the particular problem. So we would strongly urge that you not adopt this bill as written, that if you want to continue the process and narrow that window that you have to be uninsured to qualify, that you amend the particular statute now and go back to the one-year differentiation.
Hey, Mr. Nelson, thank you. Good to see you today. So what you're suggesting as an employer who owns 10 restaurants and has been continuing to try to keep as many people insured as possible, makes a decision that I can no longer afford insurance on my people, so you would suggest that I would have to keep them uninsured for a year before I could go and look at this program. That's what you're suggesting?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, this particular type of program was established to bring people who were uninsured into the market. And what Representative Greenwood he's crossed over because he's seeing, as you're suggesting, many employers who cannot afford to continue to pay the increases. And I would suggest that this particular program isn't the place to answer that question. It's to answer the question by allowing, which I want to state we would probably also oppose that, but by allowing insurers to write policies that for the general public that don't include the mandates. Now, we would have to come before you and make arguments why that particular approach also is pound foolish because of mental health. I'm not arguing the other mandates, but because what I believe mental health and alcohol and chemical dependency, what it costs employers in the long run. So I believe that's the more, and I think Mr. Powell will agree with me, that's how you would address your particular issue as opposed to in this particular program.
I think we've heard cost and heard JL throw out some costs. I couldn't believe the cost that the numbers he threw out. I think it'd be really important for this group to look at those costs. So if you could furnish us some actual data if we were to go to buy this and how that compares to some other group health plans within small businesses that are out there before we talk about somebody would jump because they would save a lot of money, because the numbers he threw out were not
savings based on some of the other health plans that I've seen out there, too. So I think that'd be important.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Last person on my list is Angela Kimball.
Thank you, Chair Galta, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Angela Kimball. I'm here representing the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. And I apologize for not being prepared for this particular bill today. But this is a very, very important bill to all of us who work in mental health and addictions. And I want to reiterate a couple points that you've heard before, but perhaps expand on them in a different way. And I want to start by simply saying one thing. The end does not justify the means. And the end here is to reduce unemployment or uninsurance. Certainly that's a goal everyone in this room is concerned about. I am as well as everyone else. Without coverage, we devastate our public systems and we devastate people's lives. However, this bill is an attempt to address the root causes of uninsurance. And I stipulate that it simply doesn't do so. If you look at the major cost drivers for insurance, they do not include mandates. That is not the number one, it's not the number two, and it's not the number three cost driver for insurance. And the difficulty with this bill is that it doesn't address the root causes of the escalating costs, and therefore it takes a different route, and it does so at the expense of being fair. It strips away coverage from the very things that we need covered, and that's mental health and chemical dependency. Every day that I walk these halls, I get calls. I get calls from staff. I get calls from audience members. I get pulled aside. The stigma of mental illness and chemical dependency is still enormous, but it stalks this building as it does every part of this state. And I have to tell you, it is a difficult thing to navigate getting services, because even with current coverage, things are difficult. People have a hard time getting the help they need. And this bill would strip out the necessity to cover mental health or chemical dependency at all. And as others have explained, this actually creates a catch-22. Because these conditions are so prevalent and so treatable, and because the mind and body are one, when you take away any ability to cover these problems, what you do is create a greater demand on other health care services. I've talked, for example, to Senator Bates, who's an emergency room physician, and what he sees routinely are people showing up in the ER room with terrible gastrointestinal, disorders, physical health disorders that are, in essence, physical manifestations of untreated major depression or anxiety disorders. Without people getting access to effective and cost-efficient care for the real problems that they're experiencing, they end up overutilizing our emergency rooms and our doctors. And the end result of that is that other health care costs escalate and other health insurance policies bear the escalating cost in their premiums. This is what others were talking about in terms of that adverse selection. When you strip away needed coverage from a certain group of people, you force those people elsewhere. You force them into other insurance markets, and you force them into uncovered care, which we all pay for eventually through higher premiums. So what you do is create uninsurance by forcing premiums up in the other markets. And then you have a catch-22 where you're always dealing with more and more uninsured and always looking for a solution without ever looking at the real cause. And the real cause is we have an insatiable desire for new technology, new medical care, hospital visits. The amount of money that's going to hospital care is 33 cents on the dollar from the research that I've done. And this is not result of mental health mandates or chemical dependency. And I have to tell you that my own organization, the Association of Oregon Counties, has traditionally been very concerned about coverage as well because they cover county and city employees. We asked our own insurance service what it would cost to offer full mental health and chemical dependency coverage. The answer that came back was 1% or less. 1% or less. In addition, the Oregon Business Association, which is very concerned about the cost to businesses, voted unanimously last week for the first time ever to endorse parity.
We're not talking about parity here.
This bill, however, is a step in the opposite direction, in that philosophically and from a cost basis, if you endorse the notions of parity, which is that coverage, full coverage of mental health and substance abuse actually lowers other physical health costs and is beneficial to businesses and lowers rates overall, then this is a step in the opposite direction. And I would stipulate that what you're trying to do here, which is to address the high cost of health insurance, is actually not achieved by the mechanisms used in this bill. And again, the end does not justify the means here. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it because of the time constraints. I know that you have figures, and if you could provide them for the committee, that would be wonderful, about the days that people miss from work and losing their jobs because of mental health, untreated mental health and substance abuse issues. If you could get us those figures, that would be really helpful. And also the figures that we heard from John Powell, that adding mental health was 2.5% higher. You thought it was less than 1%. If you could get us some of those figures, I think that would be really helpful for future hearings.
Chair Galpo, members of the committee, I'd be delighted to do so.
Thank you.
Representative Greenlick?
Yeah, I'd like to comment. I have a little problem with you speaking for all the people who work in the mental health and substance abuse field. I was doing research in that field before you were born. I can tell you, we spend too much time with a certain group of advocates, because I can tell you, if you give people a choice of having mental health coverage or no health insurance, not having money to cover that emergency room visit that you just talked, I think you'll hear a very different view. I support Senate Bill 1, as you do, but I think the notion of getting people health insurance, your statement that people would rather not have health insurance if they couldn't have health insurance with mental health coverage is absurd. And I think you ought to listen to what you're saying. I also think if you're speaking officially from the Association of Oregon Counties, I'd like to have an official statement from them on this.
Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlick, I agree. I have not been in this business for very long. In fact, I came to it as a result of my own son's illness. I can't speak officially for the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs.
Okay. I understand that. I understand the advocacy. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Thanks, Angela. With that, we'll close the public hearing.
Before we close it, Mr. Chair, could I know Rocky King is here, and I know we don't have time to hear him, but I hope if we have another hearing that we can bring Rocky King up on this bill?
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2753, and we are going to open a work session on the introduction of committee measures. Colleagues, we had, this will just take a minute, we had the language from the Invest in Kids. First, the resolution that Martha Brooks brought forward to us, Legislative Council drafted it. You should have it, the request language. Yeah, you have it in your packet there. If you want to take a moment to take a quick look at it, that's fine. But otherwise, I think we're ready for a motion. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You did create a subgroup that has looked at some of the wording, cut it down quite a bit, tried to make it really concise, and have produced this document. And upon perusal, I move that we have the resolution on child welfare and foster care submitted to Legislative Council for draft.
Okay, thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson moves that the House Committee on Health and Human Services introduce the language that we have before us to be drafted into a resolution on child welfare and foster care. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The language is ordered drafted. Thank you very much. With that, we'll close the work session. And the meeting is adjourned. Thanks.
Thank you.